Colleen has the opening bell coming up. We'll also talk with Casey McNerthney from the King County Prosecutor's Office, who is going to tell us what happens when criminals try to evade the police. But first, we're going to go to the Motor City, Detroit, where WWJ Radio's Jeff Gilbert joined us this morning. He's covering the strike, of course, now entering its second full week. And it appears as if Ford Motors may be close to a settlement with the workers. So I asked him about the details of that.
Well, Ford, I would not call it close to a settlement, but I would say Ford is ahead of their competitors, General Motors and Stellantis. Over the weekend, they actually finalized their deal with Canadian auto workers. The workers there ratified that. So that gave them a bit of a leg up here since they didn't have to worry about Canada. The other issue is that they have agreed to give workers cost of living increases and also agreed to some job security provisions. So a number of items are done, but I don't think they're done with some of the trickier things like wages and pensions.
One of the more interesting issues in this strike is what's called the tier system, where workers doing similar jobs were treated differently. The UAW wanted to get rid of that forever. So can you explain that issue to us?
Yeah, this is something that car makers have wanted forever. They wanted to pay entry-level employees less than veteran employees. So during the recession, they were able to get that concession from the union. The union has hated that ever since then for the last 15 years. They've cut away at it, and the car makers are agreeing to give people up to full wage in 4 years instead of 8 years. And the workers just say, no, we want everybody to be up to full wage, you know, after an initial probationary period. So That's an issue that could cost the car makers a lot of money, but also, you know, give workers, younger workers, a big raise.
Yeah. Now, has Ford caved on that one?
You know, it's interesting because Ford says it's eliminated tiers. The UAW says, yes, they have, and nobody else has. So we're not really sure, and the devil is going to be in the details about what exactly it means by eliminating tiers. Because if you look at Canada, all Ford agreed to was cutting the wage progression in half from 8 to 4 years. So we'll actually have to see the details when they do have a tentative agreement.
So let's talk some numbers here. What kind of wages are we actually talking about, Jeff?
We're talking about roughly a 20% wage increase is what the car companies are offering. 40% is what the union is offering. I don't have the actual pay scale right in front of me. I believe it's in the mid-30s right at this particular point, but I wouldn't want to say a specific number unless I had it in front of me.
But the idea is that the people who work the line want to make the kind of living where you can have a prosperous middle class lifestyle, as I understand it.
Well, you know, and here is where the argument is. Many of the veteran employees can make with overtime and with productivity payments and with performance bonuses, profit sharing was what I was trying to think of. With all of that together, you can make a six-figure income on the line if you're a senior veteran auto worker. Some of the younger people coming in don't make that money, and some of the temporary employees make even less money. So that's where the rub is. There are some people who make a very good middle-class wage, but the union is concerned about, they think, about 15 to 20% of the workers that don't.
Now, I know that the automakers raised the issue that if you push us too far, we're not made of money as high as our profits seem to be. If you push us too far, you may find yourself in a few years having to make concessions, which happened during the financial crisis. They had to do some givebacks. Is there any fear of that happening?
There is a huge fear of that happening because you've got Tesla, which, for example, pays much lower wages and has much lower labor costs and has been cutting prices on vehicles left and right. And as traditional car makers have to depend more on electric vehicles for their profits, and by the way, they're losing money on them right now, they're going to be competing with companies like Tesla and Vietnam's VinFast, which is building a factory in North Carolina, and Foxconn, the maker of iPhones, that wants to build vehicles in Ohio for other car makers, all of whom have lower labor costs. So, yeah, it's possible that these big profits, if they don't get a good contract, car makers' big profits could turn into big losses.
So does the union worry about that? I mean, are they taking that into consideration that they could end up pricing themselves out of the market, essentially?
At this particular point, they say no. They're looking at the current big profits that car makers are making and saying, hey, look, we're only about 4% of the cost of a vehicle. They can afford to pay us that. And the car makers are saying, no, we can't because you are our variable cost and everything else is a fixed cost. So, you know, you've got people who are on two different wavelengths here.
Wait a minute. You said labor costs are only 4% of the cost of a vehicle?
Well, yes, but 4% of the cost of a vehicle is a pretty significant chunk of change. And if you raise that up to a certain amount, it may be the difference between a profit and a loss.
WWJ's Jeff Gilbert. Jeff, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up at 7:35, has the time finally come for the good driving lotto? Also, G. Scott's going to tell us about the unsung hero of yesterday's Seahawks victory. But first, every Monday, we talk with Casey McNerthy from the King County Prosecutor's Office. And this week, he brought us the latest data on hate crimes. And so I thought that was worth a little discussion because hate crime prosecutions have changed dramatically in the last 6 months. So I asked him, what's the importance of collecting data on these hate crimes?
Well, it's important because hate crimes don't only affect the people who are in the individual crimes. It's, you know, anybody who identifies as the group that's targeted can certainly be affected by it. And we also know that hate crimes are underreported too. And so we want to share the numbers that we're seeing. So one, people know what's happening with it too, but also so other people feel safe reporting it.
And just to be clear, a hate crime doesn't necessarily require a physical assault, correct?
Right. And that was just changed in the law. Previously, it did require a physical injury. And it was not classified, surprisingly, as a crime against a person. But this last April, that changed. Yesenia Monzo is the prosecutor who's both handling the recent case at the Wing Luke Museum and each of the hate crimes that come through King County. Yesenia went to Olympia earlier this year to argue for increased protections under state law. And here's what the testimony was like to try to get that law changed, which then happened after this.
I'm not supporting that the law be changed to include behavior that is not criminal conduct. I am supporting that the hate crime law be changed to include all assaultive behavior that is motivated by bias. Second, I support that hate crimes be recategorized as a crime against a person. Hate crimes being considered a crime against a person is not only a more accurate description of the crime, as Senator Dingra pointed out, but it also comes with 12 months of community custody where DOC can supervise offenders.
And that change was accepted.
It was, and it was signed by the governor back in April. And so what the case is now is you can have a criminal act that's hateful under the law. It doesn't have to require a physical injury the way it did before.
So then how do you define it? I mean, I assume that just, a simple insult, or do you have to go beyond that?
You've got to go beyond that. And so there's a lot of hateful behavior that's not criminal. And so what it is there's got to be a credible threat that the person and a reasonable person in that targeted group would believe could be carried out.
I see. So there's got to be a threat involved.
Yep.
Not just a racial or ethnic slur, but because you are so-and-so, I'm going to do such-and-such.
Right.
Okay. So the numbers then, let's see, this covers what years now?
So far, from 2018 until last Friday, there have been 296 cases that have been filed.
So this is over 5 years then.
Right. Yep.
Okay.
And what we're seeing primarily are crimes against Black people who are most often targeted. And then people who are the second most common category are people who are targeted because of their sexual identity or perceived gender. And then after that, we're also seeing, and we certainly saw an increase in 2020 for this, people who are Asian or perceived that way.
And what kind of sentences are these people getting?
That's what surprises people, is that it's still a Class C felony, which is the lowest type of felony. And I'm sure that if lawmakers were to say, you know, we'd like to move that up to a Class B or a Class A, that our office would support it. Sometimes it depends the statewide guidelines set by those state lawmakers. It depends on what somebody's previous history is. So if you're a first time offender, it can be a few months up to a year. It's less than what people think it is. If you're somebody who's got two or three or four felonies and a lot of terrible behavior in your past, it'll be more.
Yeah. Okay. On another matter, what is the status of people who try to elude the police on prosecuting people like that?
Those cases are filed almost every day, and very few people hear about them because they're so routine. I think there's an idea of, you know, are people being charged for this? And here are the numbers. Last year, for the entire year, there was 172 of those cases over all the business days in the year. So far this year, through the end of of August, there have been 176. So we're on pace for about 240, 250 of those cases this year with the number of business days during the year. And so it's up significantly.
Okay, so you shouldn't expect to elude the police without there being some sort of penalty for doing that.
Right. You can run, and we're seeing more people doing that, and not, you know, physically running is one thing, but when you're blowing through red lights and you're, you know, screaming down an arterial at 70, 80 miles an hour, which we see, and you put everybody else at risk, that's a clear felony crime.
Yeah. Okay, a couple of updates on cases that are still pending. The Federal Way stabbing at the Holy Innocence School, what's happened there?
So last week we charged the suspect in that case with assault in the first degree with a deadly weapon enhancement, and the victim in that case so far has survived, and so that case is charged now.
And you had an organized retail theft case?
Yeah, there was a guy who was convicted and sentenced on Friday for ripping off the Louis Vuitton store at Bellevue Square and the downtown Seattle Nordstrom. He was sentenced on Friday to 4.25 years.
4.25 years?
Yeah.
That sounds like a pretty significant sentence. Now, it was organized retail theft, so what about the other people involved?
There's a co-defendant who's still, his case is ongoing. And so we'll see what happens in the next couple months on that one, and we'll keep you posted on it.
Now, what was the key to getting a sentence of that length? What kind of evidence do you have to present?
Well, there were two things. The evidence of showing that there was clearly that crime, and the work that police did both in Bellevue and Seattle to get those search warrants to show how that crime was ultimately committed. But also the key there was the person's previous history. Having multiple previous felonies increases that time behind bars significantly.
So he'd been doing this a lot, is what you're saying.
Well, other felony crimes, certainly. And so this was not his first rodeo at all.
Any indication that by pursuing these cases and putting people behind bars for years because they decide to rip off the store is having a deterrent effect?
I think on certain people it is. I'm not sure.
Well, the guy who's in jail, yeah.
In that case, yeah. I think it's pretty shocking when you hear about a sentence like that. And I think if we didn't have that sentence, if we said, yeah, you know what, you might be able to rip off Bellevue Square or stores in downtown and not have any consequences, I think we'd see more people doing it. We're not getting a lot of people saying, you know, I stopped that criminal behavior because I saw this, but that's got to have some kind of an effect.
Casey McNerthney from the King County Prosecutor's Office. Thank you, Casey.
Thanks, Dave. Good to see you.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Let's talk about cold season. It is upon us, and just in time for the beginning of cold season, a very popular drug which we use to make the symptoms a little less miserable might not be available. Let's page the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. What's going on here, Dr. Gordon?
Right. So there's a chemical found in many cold medicines called phenylephrine, and it's a popular ingredient in numerous over-the-counter allergy and cold medicines. And in fact, it's been around for a very long time. It was actually first approved in the 1970s. But phenylephrine became a lot more popular in 2005 because pseudoephedrine, which was and is the active ingredient in true Sudafed, was being abused. It was being used to make methamphetamine. It's a precursor to methamphetamine. And so it got put behind the counter. Even though it remained an over-the-counter medication, it got regulated much more closely. And so in order for them to market Sudafed more widely, they called it Sudafed PE, and the PE stands for phenylephrine. And phenylephrine replaced the pseudoephedrine. So since 2005, going on 20 years now, people have been taking Sudafed PE or other such drugs which have phenylephrine in them. And it turns out that a recent evaluation by an independent advisory committee demonstrated that, in fact, oral phenylephrine actually doesn't do anything. So although the ingredient is considered safe to use, for years, doctors have really questioned phenylephrine's effectiveness when taken orally. But these products with phenylephrine in them generate nearly $2 billion a year in sales alone. So there has been a reluctance to pull it from the market. But I think that it's possible that we may not see it in the near future because this advisory committee is now making a recommendation that it should be removed.
So it's not harmful.
it's just not clinically effective. But obviously, the fact that so many people still take it, they must at least think they're getting a benefit from it.
Well, the placebo effect is probably all they're really getting based on what the data shows. Now, let's be clear. This is when it's taken orally. In fact, phenylephrine can be taken as a nasal decongestant, as a nasal spray. And that, in fact, is effective. And in fact, many ear, nose, and throat doctors will use phenylephrine spray before they evaluate somebody to help shrink the tissues so they can have a good look inside. So phenylephrine spray is not what we're talking about right now. We're talking specifically about oral phenylephrine. And yeah, it doesn't appear to have any effect. And so based on that, people have felt that, you know, it's really not right or ethical to be selling this much product for a drug that really doesn't do anything.
But the drug does work. It just doesn't work as a pill. It works as a spray.
That's absolutely correct.
Is there some reason that somebody who takes the tablet couldn't use the spray?
No, they can use the spray, although some people don't like nasal sprays. But let's keep in mind, it is actually still possible to buy true Sudafed. That's branded as Sudafed and not Sudafed PE, or it can be purchased generically. The only difference is that in order to obtain pseudoephedrine, you have to go to the pharmacist and ask them for it. And when they give it to you, they you know, take your driver's license, they record that you've purchased it. It doesn't require a prescription, but it does require an interaction with the pharmacist and them documenting it. And that's because the drug was so widely abused. People were buying enormous quantities of it from, you know, grocery stores, drug stores, and whatnot, and using it to make methamphetamine. And in fact, it's one of the banned substances by the International Olympic Committee. And there have been numerous athletes over the past decades who've either been prevented from participating or who have even had their medals stripped from them because they tested positive for pseudoephedrine in their blood or urine.
Okay, so this shouldn't be a crisis because you can still get the real Sudafed, which does work as long as you're not buying it by the case or plan to compete in the Olympics.
That's correct. People do need to keep in mind, though, that it is a stimulant and you need to take it as prescribed. You can't take excessive amounts of it. People shouldn't be trying to use it as a diet pill. People shouldn't be using it to try and stay awake. That's not the purpose of it. It needs to be taken in appropriate doses for, you know, nasal congestion. That's what its appropriate use is. I think the most important thing of us discussing this is that, you know, it gets the information out there and tells people what their options are. If the data shows that phenylephrine as an oral agent doesn't do anything, you're probably better off not to waste your money on it. If you want to use phenylephrine as a nasal spray, it does appear to work well. If you need some oral decongestant, go to your pharmacist, ask them for real pseudoephedrine and buy it over the counter. But just, you know, don't be surprised when they ask for your driver's license. You're not doing anything wrong. You're not suspicious. It's just that's the requirement.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Your Daily Dose of Kindness now brought to you by Robert W. Baird. Never has a mail carrier been so celebrated. But the community in Milwaukee, served by Michael Booth for the last 30 years, this celebration was more than appropriate for his kindness. For three decades, he delivered his last piece of mail this weekend, then found himself in the middle of a party thrown in his honor.
How you doing, sis? How you doing?
Good. Love you.
Love you, too.
Yeah, proud
Fox
of you.
Affiliate WITI-TV says it's there he took in every hug. He's known to the community as Mailman Mike.
His personality, his smile.
But hey, I'm 20 years walking around over here. 30 years total out here in the streets, so why wouldn't I want to be nice to everybody I go past? I might need them.
He says the years have been filled with many memories.
So they tell me a lot of things sometimes, some I don't want to hear, and some they, you know, want to need somebody to confide in, why not? You know, they feel comfortable and safe sometimes, and that's cool.
And he's always there for them. At the celebration of Mailman Mike, he gave his words of wisdom for how he kept a positive attitude all these years.
When you wake up in the morning, you're brushing up teeth, why don't you make a promise, hey, I'm going to have a good day. And stick to it.
Just make a promise to yourself. The Milwaukee Common Council also honored Mailman Mike, and now he's off on a vacation to Italy.
To Italy.
Well deserved.
Where everybody's happy.
Yeah.
7:48, and now from the Gene Ursula Show, here is G. Scott. Big football weekend. You were at the Ohio State game, too.
That was that game. It was in Notre Dame in South Bend. And I got to tell you,
their game day presentation and what they do at Notre Dame, top notch. Never in my life would have thought that I would go to Notre Dame, and the DJ was one of the best things that I've taken away. It was incredible.
What was the difference for those who maybe don't watch game day and don't know the context?
Just a lot of times, like the in-game experiences, you know, there's TV timeouts, and so there's kind of a lull inside of the stadium. So sometimes you can go to some stadiums, you're like, oh, okay, hurry up. But man, Notre Dame, when it was a TV timeout or commercial break or whatever the case may be, man, they had it rocking. They had a light show in that thing. It was like a timeout. The lights came out, and everybody had all these wristbands on. It was green. It was crazy. It was just pandemonium there. It was a big game, tough game. The Buckeyes pulled it out at the last second and won 17-14 against a really good Notre Dame team. So it was a great game to be at. Junior did well. He was in there on that last play, and the DN and the linebacker absolutely destroyed him on that last. Oh, I mean, absolutely. I mean, he was like, look, there was nothing I could do in that. He's like, hey, I was there long enough for me to block for the running back to get in there. So that's all I did my job, but it's hilarious. But
so Hawks win.
Woo wee!
Is there anybody left to play next week though? That's
yes, the New York Giants. They're traveling there next week for Monday Night Football. Look, this is going to sound corny. It's going to sound cliche. The game ball has to go to the 12s. It has to go to the Seahawks fans in that stadium. The Seahawks scored 25 points in the second half. The Seahawks in the first half was, Colleen, they were asleep. You understand me? They were asleep. It wasn't looking good. It was just things weren't going right. That crowd was electric. Pete Carroll talked about it. Right now, the most false starts in a game is 8, and that was by the Carolina Panthers yesterday. The record for a game is 11, so almost broke a record yesterday. I mean, the crowd, it was, because you remember, I don't know if you guys remember this, but week 1, I was telling people just kind of how dead it was. Now, granted, the Rams were beating up on the Seahawks, but it was exciting. Now, I'll admit, there was a little help. And the 10-year anniversary of the Super Bowl 48 team was yesterday. Most of those guys were in attendance.
That's nice.
They had a halftime deal. That kind of helped with a little spark as well. The irony is, the way the Seahawks team played the second half, they played like the 2013 team. They ran the ball really well.
Mm.
They played really good defense, and the 12s in the stands was losing their damn minds.
Well, maybe the All-Stars sprinkle a little magic on the team during halftime.
It was
that's
awesome.
Great, but lots of injuries.
I mean, you know, it's part of the game. You know, yeah. You'll find out today. I mean, some didn't come back to the game. Right now, the Seahawks are not playing with their starting offensive tackles, but I will say the backup, those tackles that are come in, are playing really, really well, right? Oh,
that was Sully.
Yeah,
party foul.
They're playing really, really well. Good. You know what I mean? So
the injuries aren't something that's, you know, going to be a problem for the next game.
You know what? Party gang.
Can we talk about what might be a problem for the Broncos?
Yeah, 70-20.
That.
Ooh.
I was with a Bronco at the state fair when she got the text about the score, and she went, "Take a look at this screenshot. Is that real?" And then she just went quiet.
Did they just stop playing or what?
So I was with some of the guys from the 2013 team during that time. And one of the guys came out and was like, y'all see the score? 70-20. And everybody was like, nah, that's not real. Like,
right?
Nobody could believe it.
Yeah. That's never happened in an NFL game before, right?
I think the last time 70 points were scored was 1966. You know what I mean? Like, it's really bad.
But what? Who's to blame?
Sean Payton.
Okay.
The head coach.
The coach.
I've been saying this entire time. This is the same guy that came in and talked about how bad the last coach was.
That's right.
Right? Remember? Yeah, that guy. This is the same guy that put it out in the media that Russell needs to quit trying to kiss babies. I think Sean Payton is, whether he's going to be good for the Broncos, we will see. I think he's really bad for Russell Wilson, and I don't care what anybody's opinion is of Russell Wilson. the Denver Broncos paid him $242 million. So, Dave Ross, if you hire a coach, that coach is coming in like, hey, listen, we already paid Buddy $242 million. So it's not about getting rid of him. It's about, hey, can you fix what is going on here, right? That's your job. Yeah. And so I feel like Sean Payton is coming in like, if things go bad, I can always blame this $242 million contract that everybody is already talking about. And then once he's gone, then I can bring in my rookie quarterback.
Wait, so he's trying to get Russell Wilson fired?
I don't know. No, I don't think that. I don't know that. I'm just giving an assumption by the way he's handled things since he's been there. I think he has handled things not good. Talking about the ex-coach, putting it out there about Russell Wilson kissing babies. And so my only thing is, wait, just last thing. Who do you think most people are going to blame that now they're 0-3?
Yeah.
Right? They're going to blame the quarterback. They're not going to blame Sean Payton because Sean Payton is, he was a great coach and he coached Drew Brees. And
now we know.
Some people get a pass.
Now we know he's not so great.
Yep. See y'all.
G. Scott, 9 o'clock with us, Leroy Teens. Hope you have your shutdown kit ready because it looks like we're headed there. But let's check it out with CBS senior White House correspondent Scott McFarland. Are you still guessing that they will run out of money and shut down?
It's always darkest before it's completely pitch black. Yeah, they're on a road to nowhere this week. House Republicans are going to spend this week passing 4 spending bills, a fraction of the federal government. But their spending bills, if they do pass, are going nowhere in the Senate. The president would never sign them. So to a degree, they're using up some valuable time, something that's not going to actually happen. What the speaker is hoping to do, Dave, is to get his harder line Freedom Caucus members to see some progress that these individual spending bills that they like pass, and then agree to sign on to what they've said no to before, a short-term continuing resolution to briefly keep the government open another month or two while negotiations continue. I don't see any progress on that yet. It's quite a parlay the speaker's trying to work on. But at this point, he says he's optimistic and it may be his only hope.
Okay, so there's some semblance of regular order. They have been going through the 13 individual spending bills and trying to update them. Is that fair to say?
It is. It's also something you want to do in May and June.
Right.
Not in late.
No, I get that they're late to do it. But it's not like they've done absolutely nothing. I mean, the thing that sort of gets me upset is that I used to read the federal budget back when it was printed on paper. And it's not humanly possible to understand everything in it or root out all the waste there. But you got to make an effort. Otherwise, bad problems continue and money gets wasted. So at least some of that work went on this year. Can you at least say that?
Absolutely. The appropriations committees did their work. But the problem is when they try to get one of those big fat paper defense spending bills that would fund Joint Base Lewis-McChord and every other military installation in America, the Republicans couldn't even agree to take up the debate and to have a debate over that big, lengthy bill, which has so many good things in it and would, to a degree, potentially cut some of the deficit. There is a fight internally among House Republicans that has paralyzed progress, even though their Appropriations Committee did its work and did it on time.
Okay, so they're using this as leverage, obviously. What is it what's the non-negotiable that the Freedom Caucus, and I guess are they controlling the ball here? What is it that they insist on?
Any 5 members of the House Republican Conference have veto power right now. It just so happens on this issue, like other issues this year, it's the Freedom Caucus. They want much more significant cuts in overall spending, citing the ballooning and unsustainable federal budget deficit. And they don't want any of those short-term deals, those continuing resolutions that move the goalposts a little bit, because they say that's a problem that further exacerbates deficits.
Yeah. Yeah, but overall spending, the phrase overall spending, though, you know, what do we do with that? Is there some specific program that they think is wasteful that just needs to go, or are they just looking at the number and they don't care how you meet that number?
Oh, a whole bunch. But non-military, non-homeland security, which means they're cutting into other programs much more significantly than Democrats would be willing to stomach. You think about issues involving federal education, climate change initiatives, environmental protection, treasury programs to help the IRS avoid backlogs. But it's not just the dollar amount that's a poison pill for Democrats. It's some of the language. It would really defund a lot of climate change initiatives, diversity programs in the federal government, LGBTQ services. These things will never ever pass the U.S.
Right.
Senate.
But how much money do they represent? So this is not about the dollar amount. Those programs are, as I understand it, insignificant when it comes to the overall federal budget.
They're rounding errors. That language is what I think some of the more moderate Democrats and Republicans say we got to get rid of, because this is saving us nothing and it's causing us all kinds of gridlock. That's where I think a lot of the people trying to find a middle ground would start. Let's get rid of this language that is clearly not tolerable by Democrats and not making a dent in the budget. The harder part is the point you made. There are a lot of people, both parties, who want to see budget deficits reduced and are supportive of some cuts in federal programs. Problem here is that it's all concentrated into a small subset of what Washington pays for. They aren't touching Social Security or Medicare or military.
Mm-hmm. So, and they're not, of course, not going to raise taxes. So
and
that's
a non-starter.
Right. Yeah. So that's where the crunch comes from. All right. So we're headed for a shutdown. How long will it be? And this is my concern, having just come back from flying on vacation. Would the shutdown cut down on the number of TSA personnel at the airports and create lines?
That's going to cause problems for the TSA workers, not the passengers. They will work for no paychecks, and that's a problem for any number of Americans who have one, you know, family incomes or live paycheck to paycheck. Essential workers will still have to report. Military-based workers will still have to report in large number. Veterans, doctors will have to report. They just won't get paid, which is a pernicious problem, and it's also a blow to the economy, because when you start idling federal workers or taking their money away, they stop spending money, and that hurts the economy in any number of ways. How long will it be? Last two were measured in days. The one in 2018 lasted about a month and a half. The one in 2013, I remember it to this day, it lasted 2 full weeks,
mm-hmm.
and it caused all kinds of political ripples.
Explain that to me. How is it legal to force someone to work? Didn't we deal with that like back in the 1800s?
Yeah, there's a really obscure law called the Anti-Deficiency Act, which prevents the government from having deficiencies that put life and limb in danger, and which prevents the government from going empty and hollow. Who's essential becomes a real art, not a science, Dave, and they're going to litigate that over the first week of this shutdown if it starts Sunday morning. Who's considered essential? Are park workers considered essential? Are federal meat inspectors considered essential? There's a whole lot of flexibility in there, so that'll impact the pain of this shutdown. But no matter what, they're not going to get paid. They'll get paid eventually, but they'll be getting back pay, not front pay, and that's destabilizing to any number of American households.
Well, not everybody can float themselves, alone of a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks. So what if TSA workers just say, heck, I'm calling in sick?
Yeah, and that's going to happen to some degree if it passes any prologue. But also, you can't take your leave. You can't take paid leave during a shutdown. So people who have, things like vacations, weddings, family commitments, school projects that they have to be there for their kids, you can't take the leave, which also complicates things. It seems small until you cumulatively measure that it's federal workers across the country hit by this. It can be very destabilizing.
Right. All right. So get ready. As I say, have your shutdown kit handy, which may mean arriving. Let's see. I arrive 3 hours early for most flights now. Maybe it's time to arrive 4 hours early. And at some point, it's better just to take the train, right?
Well, SeaTac is an awesome airport. We all can agree on that.
Yes, it is. We call it SEA now, by the way. It's the new cool name, SEA.
I like it better.
Yeah. Right. Scott McFarland, CBS News. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you will never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.